Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Michael Isikoff.
And this is Spy Talk. Got another crazy wink at the office of Tulsi Gabbard. My God, I mean, what amateur hour over there. We got, you know, this is after Signalgate and talking about war plans out in the open, so to speak. And now we have the revelation that Joe Kent, the former Green Beret, January 6th denier, pro-Russian blogger, et cetera, who is the chief of staff to Tulsi Gabbard. You know, we now have memos of him instructing his top intelligence analysts, you know, how to write their intelligence reports that will conform with, that will line up with the administration's or Trump's view that Venezuela is invading the United States.
Yeah, you know, this whole story is the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, these new emails from Joe Kemp, Gabbard's chief of staff, trying to get the National Intelligence Council chief to doctor his assessment that there is no evidence that the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro is sponsoring, providing support for this criminal gang trend to Aragua to come into the United States as part of an invasion, right?
Boom, my head is exploding again. Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, when is this going to end? I'm sick of talking about these people. Why don't they just put their heads down and actually do professional intelligence work? That would be nice to see. And I should mention here, we're going to have on Steve Cash, a former senior intelligence official who has started up something called the Steady State, which is a huge organization of national security professionals who are very worried about this kind of bending of intelligence. But
Right. But just can we just like just quote a little from what Joe Kent is writing to Michael Collins, the acting chief of the National Intelligence Council?
Sure.
We need to do some rewriting, he says, after he reads the National Intelligence Council assessment contradicting what the president has proclaimed.
He should be an editor.
And he goes on to say, we need to do some rewriting so this document is not used against DNI or POTUS. So there you have it, as clear political statement from a top intelligence official to doctor intelligence reporting to conform with what the administration wants to say.
You know, if this were only some, you know, a parlor game of, you know, bureaucracies and intelligence nerds, you know, going at each other or something. But as I wrote this week, I was so obvious, but I felt compelled to write that, you know, bad intelligence, twisting intelligence can have very bad outcomes. That's how we ended up in Iraq.
Right.
With, should we list all the casualties? One other time to list all the deaths and casualties. Vietnam, twisting intelligence to fit the policy. 58,000 American troops dead in Vietnam, millions of Vietnamese died, and so on. Right. So this is not just a bureaucratic kerfuffle.
Yes,
this has consequences.
Absolutely. Although I will give these guys credit for something, which is they don't they're completely transparent about their goal to politicize intelligence and law enforcement. I mean, I on the law enforcement end, I was just really struck by this guy Ed Martin, who was the wacky interim U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, who was just too far out there, even for the Republican Senate. Trump had to withdraw his nomination for Martin to be U.S. attorney. So they move him to a top job in the Justice Department, overseeing the weaponization of justice task force. And here's his quote. This is Ed Martin's public on the record quote about what he plans to do in going after the president's political enemies. If they can be charged, we'll charge them. But if they can't be charged, we will name them. And in a culture that respects shame, they should be people that are shamed. So here you have a top guy at the Justice Department saying he's going to use the powers, the prosecutorial powers of the Justice Department, to shame people who he can't charge with crimes, which is like a complete rewriting of what the purpose of the Justice Department is and its ethos that you they're there to target crimes, not people. And here they're going to use it to just score political points. It's pretty shocking.
And there's some great irony here, of course. You know, the title of Cash Patel's book was about American gangsters or something like that. And here we have gangster-like behavior in the Justice Department. Let's move on. Right. We can beat that drum forever.
All right.
And we will be beating it forever. But we had a violent incident last night, very sad, kind of a deranged ideological wanderer, has some sort of affection for socialism of some sort. And he murdered, he's being charged with murdering a very nice young Israeli couple who were about to be engaged.
Well, Israeli diplomats who were attending an event at the Capitol Jewish Museum in D.C. It actually was an event that was trying to talk about how to make some progress between Israelis and Palestinians to do something about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. I mean, these were these particular two young people seem to have made special efforts to reach out along those lines and to have this guy who actually comes from some Chicago resident, part of some Marxist splinter group run by a central committee in which members are supposed to adhere to the policies of the central committee, whether they agree with them or not.
And didn't they say that he hasn't been around for a long time or something like that?
They said he was briefly a member. But it gives you it's an insight, first of all, into the fact that there are a lot of really wacky extremist groups out there that are engaged in what can only be called domestic terrorism. This seems to be on the rise. And it comes just a few days after this other bizarre incident in California, Palm Springs, where this nihilist guy, Guy Edward Bartkus, blows up a fertility clinic. And at first, people thought this might be some sort of anti-abortion thing.
Yeah, or
one-off. But it turns out it's something very different. And it's this sort of new extremist movement, which the FBI calls nihilistic violent extremism, that's been manifest in a online network called 764. Right?
Yeah.
This is the FBI Assistant Director David Scott, head of counterterrorism. We see a lot of things, but this is one of the most disturbing things we've seen. These are people who using online platforms such as social media sites, and video gaming platforms to tape victims who have been coerced into making graphic pornography or committing self-harm and killing themselves on camera. The footage is then circulated among other members to use to extort and control the victims. I never heard of this 76764
group. Yeah, it's global, according to a report I read this morning.
FBI has 250 investigations.
Yeah, and this is in the States. According to the London Times story I read, it's a global operation. I'll be interested to see follow-up reporting on what forces might be behind this, you know, out of Russia or China, encouraging this kind of spontaneous chaos. And political disintegration really is the bottom line, social disintegration. And that's the object, that's the objective of our enemies, is to just sow chaos here. And I wouldn't be surprised if we trace this to some, you know, organized effort, but there's a lot to be learned. But you're right. In general, there's just violence springing up from extremist groups of all kinds, right? And now we have some sort of putative leftist.
Kind of has this like end of days, Lord of the Flies feel to it, that we are devolving as a culture and society.
Well, speaking of, you gotta say it starts at not to beat up this drum again, but it really starts in a way, or is encouraged at the top. There's a wonderful thing going on with Kash Patel and his sidekick, Joe Bongino, the deputy director.
Dan Bongino.
These guys built their careers on being extremists, you know, and peddling conspiracy theories and so on. And so now, it's been reported this week, you know, the MAGA extremists that they encouraged, you know, and they built their careers on, they're saying, well, where's the conspiracies you guys were going to uncover when you got to Washington? You know, what about Epstein? You know, what about Hunter Biden and all these conspiracies that you guys were talking about for years? All right, now you run the FBI. Aren't you going to uncover? Yeah, and they're going, well, wait, you know.
I think they both, Patel and Bongino, did a joint interview with Maria Bartiromo of Fox the other day. And she asks about Epstein, and they say, well, you know, he actually did commit suicide in that cell. And they both say,
MAGA world is not happy
MAGA
with that.
MAGA world heads started to explode. Wait a second. Yeah.
So they've unleashed these genies from the bottle, you know. These are top, I mean, it blows my mind. This is the director of the FBI and his deputy director, who have no business running the FBI. They are not law enforcement professionals by any stretch of the imagination. And they built their careers on peddling conspiracy theories. And now they're running the FBI. So, you know, is it any great surprise that we have, you've got the president of the United States making up stuff in a meeting with a South African president about, you know, conspiracies to murder white farmers in South Africa. Baseless. Yeah. I mean, not that white farmers aren't murdered, but this whole, he and showed pictures.
Most of those murdered are actually black farmers.
Farmers. You know, he showed, Trump showed pictures of what he called mass burial grounds, and there's nothing to that. So, you know, we've got conspiracy culture going on here. And it's no surprise that some people aren't just crazed and fall victim to, you know, some online cult, some satanic death cult. I mean, oh, my gosh. Well, anyway.
All right. We have a voice of sanity as our guest today.
I'm looking forward to getting back to Earth, you know, with Steve Cash. And we'll have him for you in a short bit of time.
Right.
Stand by. Stephen Cash, welcome to Spy Talk. What a career you've had. You've traversed across the top of the intelligence world. You started in a Manhattan district attorney's office, my God. And then you were in CIA as a lawyer at CIA, and then in operations at CIA, and then you end up at, well, you've done lots of things, but DHS intelligence. So now you've put together, or you and colleagues have put together, an organization called the Steady State, which I want you to explain exactly what you do. Are you the face of the deep state? You've just surfaced now.
Well, there is no deep state, just the steady state. But thanks for having me.
So what is the steady state?
What is the steady state? The steady state is what is the reality of the U.S. government generally and the national security part of the U.S. government specifically. It represents the fact that we have a professional civil service that have worked in all different dimensions of the U.S. government. They're not a deep state in the nefarious kind of way that that term implies. And in fact, scholars used it for that purpose. That's where the term comes from. It represents in some ways the best of what the United States government is. It's what gives us stability. It's what gives us expertise. It's what keeps us from falling into an autocracy.
Well, let me just ask you for on a factual basis here. This is an organization of some 250 plus intelligence professionals and law enforcement professionals who have banded together as an organization to do what?
Well, in the shortest form, to protect the United States, we're terrified. We are in existence in order to do our best to help preserve what we understand are the core values of our nation and why we did public service in the first place. The rule of law, Constitution, the idea that we have a divided government that's that is intended to be a check on each part on the other, and the idea that we have core values of civil liberties that are both formal in the sense of constitutional and legal, but are deeply held ethical views that most Americans share. That's why we're in existence.
So not to put too fine a point on it, you are lobbying for what?
I don't know if lobbying is the right word, but we are speaking to, and we want to educate our fellow citizens. We want to speak to the Congress. We want to help the media speak to our fellow citizens. That's why I'm here today. And we want them to understand what's at stake, the danger we're in, and a danger that we see from a perspective of having seen its close brothers and cousins and sisters overseas in most of our careers. We want to help people understand what the nation is facing right now, alert them to it, and help arm them with the kind of facts and the knowledge that will help them resist what we're seeing in this nation right now.
So let me ask you, Steve, to about the critique that would come from people inside the Trump administration or allies saying, look, we had a democratic election in this country last November, and the public elected Donald Trump as president. And it ought to be the job of the people in the intelligence community and the law enforcement community and the rest of the government to support the agenda of the elected president. And if they're not inclined to do so, they should look for employment elsewhere. I mean, this is the argument that you'll get from the Trump folks.
Elections have consequences.
Elections have consequences. We elected this guy president. He has an agenda. He's implementing the agenda. Is it the job of the people in the intelligence community to support the agenda of the elected president?
Well, remember, we're not in the intelligence community anymore. We are our former members of the intelligence community.
Right.
And our job is to be good citizens. And part of that is critiquing a president, whether elected narrowly or in a landslide, about what that agenda is, how that agenda is carried out. And part of that critique that's coming from us is both directed at elements of the agenda, to the extent we understand what that agenda is, and also what appears to be a view that because this president was elected, and unquestionably he was, that the constitutional and the statutory rules, not to mention the norms, that apply to all presidents and somehow do not apply to him. Yes, presidents have agendas, but presidents affect agendas within a constitutional structure.
Your point seems to be, tell me if I'm wrong here, your point seems to be that the intelligence community should be disconnected from policy. It's not the role
from
of intelligence.
Politics.
From politics and policy. I mean, CIA is not set up to, for one, is not set up to marshal intelligence for the president's policies, any president's policies. It's set up to offer unvarnished, neutral advice or facts to the president, not to argue for a particular policy. Of course, being human, they do. I mean, you know, the hunt for bin Laden. I watched a wonderful documentary last night on the hunt for bin Laden. I thought, well, I'm not really interested in this. I know everything about it, but it's so well done. And in that case, Leon Panetta, he set the stage in motion for this hunter-killer operation to get bin Laden. And that was, in a sense, a policy advocate. So, which Joe Biden, it must be reminded, Joe Biden was against the operation to go after bin Laden.
As was Bob Gates. I watched the documentary as
Gates,
well.
Right.
And I thought that was
Secretary
pretty fascinating, actually, that mm-hmm. you had two senior members of the Obama administration that were opposed to the operation.
Yeah.
And intelligence supported it.
There's a wonderful moment in the documentary where the President Bush, not long after 9/11, says to Rumsfeld, then Defense Secretary, how soon can you marshal a force to invade Afghanistan and get al-Qaeda? And he said, 6 months. And then Bush turns to CIA and Cover Black says, I can have them dancing on eyeballs, flies dancing on eyeballs in 6 weeks. And Bush says, I'm going with you guys. And Rumsfeld sort of gobsmacked.
Well, boy, you've opened up a box there. So let me track through the way you posed that to me, and because there are a couple of different answers there. So what you first said is that the intelligence community should not be involved in politics. And with that, I would absolutely agree. I will explain that we are no longer in the intelligence community, the people who are in the steady state. We are citizens. Politics is how decisions are made in a democracy. And we not only can, but in many cases should involve ourselves in politics after we're left. After we have left.
Speaking of that, you have this infamous letter that some 51 former intelligence officials signed about the Hunter Biden laptop. And that seemed to, flap back on the signers of this advertisement saying that the Hunter Biden laptop thing was a Russian influence operation. So there's a pitfalls in getting involved in politics.
Well, let me make the distinction between getting involved in politics as the intelligence community and people who used to work in the intelligence community. But I keep saying you opened an interesting box there. So let me walk through a few things there.
Sure.
So first, that distinction is extremely important. Now, having said that, when you've left the intelligence community, you're a citizen and you can and in many cases should be involved in politics. In our case, I think most of us would have preferred not to become involved in politics. A lifetime of working in the intelligence community. And by the way, let me underscore that around a third of our members are intelligence community formers. Another third is State Department. And the other third is bits and pieces of other places, oversight from the Hill, a few academics, FBI law enforcement side. But going back to your point, most of us would prefer not to be involved in politics, having left the community. And I think most of us expected to be happily retired and doing whatever you do with it when you're retired, getting involved in the local school board if you need some politics involved. We formed together because we think that this is an existential threat. And we're certainly out of our comfort zone, our safe space, where we're most comfortable, which is not talking in this area, not being on a podcast like this.
Existential threat. That's pretty strong language.
Yeah, that is strong language.
What's the existential threat?
I think that right now, American democracy, rule of law democracy, is under threat in a way that is very similar to what we've seen overseas. Yeah, I know that is strong language. It better be strong language or I wouldn't be doing this. And I don't think most of the 200, and it's now 275 people, would be doing it either. But you began with, you made a second point, which is a really important point, and it's a distinction between obviously two similar words, which is the intelligence community as the intelligence community not being involved in policymaking. And that in some ways has, you know, rule of law dimensions, but it's also in some ways a tradecraft dimension. If you allow your intelligence community to become involved in the policymaking, and we've seen this in many other countries over time, you end up with a situation that the intelligence starts to support the policy and vice versa. And then the intelligence becomes less and less valuable. So, you know, there's an old adage told, I don't know if this is actually true, that at times when pre-World War II, when the intelligence organizations, to the extent they existed then, became involved in the policies with respect to Japan, not surprisingly, Army intelligence felt that our policies should address the danger of Japan in the context of a land war in Asia, while the Navy thought it should be a maritime war in the Pacific. What a surprise. If you are involved in the policy, it is very hard for the intelligence agencies who are writing the analysis, who are doing the collection, if they're also making the policy, not to support that policy. It's human nature. And we know how dangerous that can be. So that separation is a fundamental of particularly analytic tradecraft in the United States and has been for many years. We understand the dangers there. And the most recent events with Venezuela are a perfect example of
that. That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about, Steve, because we have, you know, fresh evidence of the politicizing of intelligence just today with the revelations about the emails that Joe Kent, yep, Tulsi Gabbard's chief of staff, sent to the head of the National Intelligence Council, telling him basically to rethink his assessment that there was no evidence of a connection between the Maduro government and the Trinidad-Aragua criminal gang. He tells them, rethink it. So this document is not used against DNI or POTUS. They're clearly looking for supporting intelligence for what the president said and what Gabbard had said publicly, rather than what the intelligence actually showed. So I want to get your reaction to that. And also, I notice in your bio, most recently when you were in the government, you were actually a senior intelligence advisor at the Department of Homeland Security. And I wonder if this issue, and this was during the latter years of the Biden administration, had come across your radar.
Yeah, this is one of the cardinal sins. It's a mortal sin in the intelligence community. Once you start drafting intelligence to support a policy, you're not drafting intelligence anymore. You're now in the public relations business, a very different business. And the touchstone there is not truth, it's persuasiveness. And if you'd wanted to go into advertising, there are plenty of jobs on Madison Avenue for that. It's not really worth the money that we spend on intel if that's what you want. It does not help a decision to be made. It obscures the factual and analytic underpinnings that we would hope any president would want to use when they're making decisions, particularly ones in the national security area. I don't want to belittle the domestic side, and I'm sure the Department of Agriculture does important things, but outside my world, if we're thinking of having a war or imposing tariffs, disrupting economic systems, throwing people out of the country, we want to do it because it reflects reality as best understood by all the tools we can have. And if you start essentially rewriting or pre-writing or editing the intel that's coming to you, I mean, Kent should have written it himself if he wanted to tell himself what the policy was good. Look, I mean, I obviously can't get into any of the intel, and I wasn't an analyst at DHS. My job was much more focused on what's called the intelligence enterprise at DHS, which is the cluster of intelligence elements within the various components of DHS. But, you know, the Venezuelan gangs in the United States is no new thing. People have been looking at it for quite some time, both within the community and outside the community. So, but I can tell you, and I'm certainly not going into classified and saying, you know, there wasn't even a hint that you should write the intel to support whatever it is the Biden administration wanted to do with respect to Venezuela or elsewhere. And not only the Biden. I mean, I've worked through Bush and Clinton and Biden. Nothing
so
like
what,
that.
So what should be the consequences given these revelations? I mean, should Joe Kent remain in his job as chief of staff at DNI?
Well, and he's the nominee to run the National Counterterrorism Center.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Well, the immediate consequences would be, I would hope, our oversight committees take a real hard look at this. And in fact, the Steady State wrote a letter to the two committees urging exactly that. Although Joe Kent's name hadn't yet appeared, it was just, please look into the reporting, which mm-hmm. at that point was still... We heard that.
Well, my first reaction is forget about it. The Republicans who are running the House and Senate Intelligence Committees aren't about to do anything that crosses Trump. Do you have any intelligence to share with us that there is interest, there's movement, that there's going to be any oversight on this issue of manipulating intelligence?
I am ever the optimist, so I'll go with my optimism. At some point, my hope is that the flood of evidence of malfeasance and misfeasance in the administration of the national security community will be sufficient to motivate at least some of both parties to put country in front of politics and, you know, a little bit of courage in front of fear and do something. That's one of the things I think the Steady State can help a little
bit. Can I ask, what are you hearing from people who are still inside the intelligence community, the CIA and ODNI about this?
Not much. And people are appropriately careful on talking outside. I certainly was when I was inside. Mm-hmm. But the sense I get that people are also very scared. I mean, we're talking.
Yeah, but
explain that. People are very scared.
For a couple of reasons. One, let's start with it appears to follow you whether you're in or out. We talked about the letter on the Hunter Biden laptop, and we can come back to that because you made some comments on it I'd like to follow up on. There's a lot of fear out there that if you run afoul of this administration, you could face things like calls for your prosecution or social media saying that you're treasonous. And then you have to start worrying about who's going to come to your house.
Do your friends who are still in, let's be honest about this. You can drop into any of the watering holes along Route 123 down from CIA headquarters and overhear, you know, sidle up to the bar at Jay Gilbert's, for example, and overhear some, and see some body language about what's going on at CIA. Do your friends that are still on the inside, do they indicate that they are being watched closely?
I've heard some of that. I think more reported in the media than from my friends, but there is an element of having to worry about the person in the office next to you and what situation are they in? And I hate to say whose side are they in? And a sense we've already heard reports about very aggressive use of polygraph at DHS. I haven't heard that confirmed, but
at DHS,
that was reported over the last week.
Do you mean ODNI?
No, I mean DHS looking for leaks primarily, although they seem to go far afield. I got to tell you, I'm also, you know, hearing it from reporters I talk to that they're worried that they will. I am not talking to any reporters now, with almost no exception, who haven't switched over to Signal. Everybody is concerned that they're being monitored. Everybody is concerned that they could be subpoenaed. People talking to reporters and people who are the reporters. So I think there is a sense of fear. And when you start to see the text of the executive orders, take Chris Krebs, for instance, as a good example. I've never seen an EO like any of these EOs. They look much more like the kind of diktats that would be issued by leaders in the former Soviet Union, or the pronouncements that you would get, that you would sometimes hear from sort of warlord types. It's naming people by name. We have pardons of the January 6th people. People are worried about their physical safety. Now I can tell you, members of the steady state are worried about their physical safety. The letter on Hunter Biden is an interesting example. And, you know, we've already talked a little bit about the idea of formers speaking when it matters. You know, I went back and I wasn't a signatory of that letter, but I would say that, you know, if I had, it just hadn't come across my radar, to tell you the truth. But if you read that letter, in my view, it's pretty measured. It is calling attention to what appears to me a well-founded danger. It uses language that's very measured. Has all the indications of.
Yeah, but it was written for political effect, and it achieved its desired political effect because the headline on reporting on that letter was invariably CIA formers say this is a Russian disinformation. The nuance in the letter was obscured over and lost, and it had a political effect. And let's be clear, it was wrong. I mean, the laptop was real. It was used by the FBI in the successful prosecution of Hunter Biden, and the 51 intelligence officials who were acting at the behest of indirectly the Biden campaign were serving a political purpose. And using their intelligence expertise for a political purpose.
I'm not going to quarrel because I don't think I'm capable of quarreling with the issue, whether it was real or right or wrong. But I mean, you're treading in the area, and this is actually important, where, you know, we use political as a bad word. But in fact, is it political to warn the people who make the decisions eventually through a political process of dangers, including external dangers?
Right.
Would it be political for a similar letter to have been written by former intelligence people in 1940, warning of the continued danger from what became the Axis, both Germany and Japan?
Right.
Yes, it would have been introduced into the political process, of course.
But, you know, it seems to me next time around, intelligence officials better have a better factual basis to attack law enforcement than they produced in this advertisement during the campaign at the behest of the Biden administration. Not that they needed to be asked, but...
But look, can I like expand on this a little bit? Because it strikes me that we have gone pretty far from down the road of formers becoming actively involved in politics in ways that we hadn't seen before. Now, I'm thinking of two recent examples, and one I'll give you an email that popped up on my inbox the other day.
Okay, I'm looking forward to hearing that.
With the headline, "A former CIA director needs you to read this." Got my attention. I clicked on the email, and the email proceeds. "Patriot, this conversation is strictly off the record, but Mike Pompeo needs you to see something urgently. You've been granted exclusive access to a secret memo, one that every decision we made had one common thread. We did it to protect American lives, but I'm sounding the alarm today because we're heading straight for a turning point, the 2026 midterms. If we don't get prepared right now, the wrong people, i.e. the Democrats, could take power." And it was a fundraising email. So I'm trying to think of, you know, the long history of former CIA directors who, by and large, would not have signed on to something like this and been out there hustling, using their former expertise and credentials to raise money for a political party. And here's Mike Pompeo doing it. And I want to put that also next to the other story this week of James Comey, former FBI director, who, you know, posts on social media, 86-47, which immediately got pounced on by all the Trump people as saying this was a call to assassinate Donald Trump. Comey says, no, I didn't even know that's what 86 meant, but I assumed it was a political message. Now, again, former FBI directors in the past were not posting political messages in the world. So you have Comey and Pompeo. I see this as two sides of the same coin and not necessarily a good one for the country.
It is not good that we're there, but I don't think it's two sides of the same coin. There's a head and a tail of this coin, and they're very different. I don't know what was going through Jim Comey's head, obviously.
It's an industry on its own.
Yeah.
It is not accidental that we are seeing many more people who normally would have kept out of electoral politics involving themselves. And the ones that I know, and I don't know Jim Comey personally, so I haven't asked them.
Right.
Are getting involved, and frankly, I'm one of them. I'm involved because I think that part of that email message to you was actually correct. That it is a very important election. The one in 2024 was a very important election did not represent a battle with what we used to call a partisan battle, in which two different parties with different views of how to accomplish things within a system of constitutional rule of law democracy fought out their policy issues. The term I've been using lately is I feel like we're in a post-partisan world, that we're not really talking about making decisions within the democracy. We're talking about whether we want to have a democracy or something else. And I think that's what's motivating a Jim Comey, whether the way his motivation was manifest makes sense. I don't want to criticize his shell placement, or somebody else's shell placement. I don't know. But there's a fundamental difference, and we've been lucky enough in this country that the luxury of our national security personnel, our Army, our Navy, the intel services, the State Department, could rest pretty comfortably. Like, I don't really care what happens in our national elections to the extent that I would step outside my role and involve myself. Mm-hmm. And historically, that's the way we all looked at it. You know, the transition from Clinton to Bush for me was I didn't even know what happened practically. I mean, I ended up leaving the agency afterwards because I got a different job offer, but you have inauguration day. Maybe you get off early because of the traffic. I think they probably had early dismissal or something like that. And that was the only thing that mattered. So this is very different.
Let's not lose sight of the fact that one thing that is a deep and profound concern is the Trump administration's alignment with Russian foreign policy goals, in particular Ukraine. The Europeans have decided and have been public about saying that Trump has aligned himself with the Kremlin, certainly has adopted its talking points on Ukraine. And for those of us who are Cold War babies, so to speak, this is profoundly upsetting, the idea that we would swing to the other side, be against NATO. So I think that's a very big motivating factor here on the part of former intelligence professionals. This is not about partisan politics. This is about a profound shift toward authoritarianism, aligning with other authoritarians across the globe. And particularly Vladimir Putin. So that's a big factor here.
You're absolutely right. And it's a big factor for, I think, two basic reasons. One, the absolute horror of aligning with a Vladimir Putin. I mean, that is a policy decision that is deeply, deeply disturbing. Whether it's enough to have brought people into the political arena, I'm not quite sure. which leads me to the second reason why it's important, because it's also symptomatic of something else. The alignment with a Putin, with leaders in Hungary, with leaders in Turkey, is a policy that seems to demonstrate a hostility to core values of constitutional rule of law and civil liberties. The rejection and contempt for our similarly organized allies in Western Europe, particularly, the furor at NATO, all are independently terrible policies in my view. But I'm not a policy guy. But I think they're terrible policies. But they're also emblematic of somebody who likes autocrats.
For my part, I hope you keep the feet to the fire on the Hill about politicizing intelligence. I must say that I hope we'll see more leaks about the manipulation of intelligence, especially in regard to Russia. I look forward to the leak from inside the ODNI or CIA of top officials trying to align intelligence on Russia with the goals of the Trump administration. And I expect we will see leaks like that as long as this radical policy shift takes place.
Can I ask just a few questions about your career in the intel world?
Sure.
Because it's a little unusual. You were a lawyer. You are a lawyer. You were a DA. You joined the CIA as assistant general counsel, but then 2 years later, you switched to the director of operations, which is an unusual career path, I think. Your bio says you were awarded the CIA's Medal of Merit for your work on a sensitive project.
Yeah.
Yeah, cough it up.
What was the sensitive project?
It's the sensitive one.
It's a long time ago. Come on.
I worked on a bunch of stuff. I worked on Hezbollah. I worked on proliferation. I worked on the Balkans. I worked on you move around a lot at the agency.
What'd you make of the Israeli pager operation against Hezbollah?
You always have to admire the Israelis' tradecraft. They're very good at doing a lot of things. Like a lot of these kind of operations that have been reported on, and are you getting my personal opinion, I don't know over the mid and long term whether they accomplish the goals that we think they will. The idea that you could kill your way out of the type of long running, deeply complicated, sort of tribal, intra and international conflicts that you can just blow other people up and get yourself out of it, I don't think it's proven to have worked in many circumstances. So I don't know if it made Israel safer. I'm no expert on, you know, the conflict in Israel, but in general, you know, I could appreciate the tradecraft, but I'm just not sure it gets you where you want to be. But they're very good at what they do.
Well, we now have a leak on the Israeli plan to attack Iran. Iran's nuclear facilities, and it's very interesting that the details of that leak are, you know, that the U.S. intelligence assessment is Israel going alone is not going to set back the Iranian nuclear program by any great degree. They really need U.S. warfighter and airplane fighter and bomber support with bunker busting bombs and so on to really put a big dent in the nuclear Iran's nuclear program. So that's an interesting leak. I mean, you know, on the one hand, I'm glad to see these leaks shedding light on debates within the administration. On the other hand, I'm sad to see all these leaks because it shows such disarray in the community and lack of trust in the intelligence rank and file and the leadership of the intelligence organization. So, but that's where we are, just in kind of a chaos situation. So
it's chaotic. And I think a lot of the leaks now are being driven by a sense of desperation and fear. I hope I don't offend either one of you. I really hate leaks. I mean, I'm an agency guy. We shouldn't have leaks.
We're pro-leak here at Spy Talk.
I understand.
We like transparency.
Let me just give you my 30-second defense of leaks, okay?
Really?
Okay. When you look back at all the controversies that have plagued the intelligence community in the pre-Trump, 20 years, you know, the Iraqi WMD debacle, the
Pentagon Papers,
The Pentagon Papers, but also, you know, extreme interrogation techniques, waterboarding,
CIA drug testing programs, assassinations,
and you know, NSA surveillance, all of which led to actual changes by Congress and administrations to the way the intelligence community was doing business. And it was only because of the leaks of classified information. We would have known nothing about the dissents within the intelligence community to Iraqi WMD and ties to al-Qaeda in the run-up to the Iraq war had it not been for leaks. We would have known nothing about waterboarding and enhanced interrogation techniques and CIA black sites had it not been for leaks. So there is a case to be made.
I'll go farther. It's not that there is a case to be made. The case is made. I don't like leaks. From the perspective of somebody on the inside, as an American citizen, I completely agree with you. They have been incredibly important and in some cases essential to moving forward in protecting the very things that the intelligence community is there to protect. No question about it. And I understand there's a little bit of a psychological tension here. I could speak to my therapist. But the idea, you know, what I find not persuasive, but that drives the way I think about this. Each of the examples you gave, I wish we didn't need to have the leaks.
And it's fair to say that these leaks animate your organization, the Steady State. You guys wouldn't be getting as much traction as you're getting if there weren't these leaks showing these terrible manipulations of intelligence. And speaking of which, we have to leave it there. We're well past our usual time. But it's,
okay. Well, look, we got to be going here.
Been fascinating discussion.
We could go on.
Steve Cash.
We could go on. Yeah. And look, we're here. And the reason I am here today with you is why the Steady State, as so much of our efforts, are going to talk to our friends in the media. You won't get any leaks, I don't think. I can't. On the other hand, we have a lot of perspective, and it's important perspective. So that's one of the things we're trying to do. I hope you'll have me again on, or one of my, or better yet, one or more of my colleagues from the Steady State.
Well, certainly will if they arrive with leaks, that's for sure.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for coming on, Steve. Yeah. For Michael Isikoff and me, Jeff Stein, thanks for listening to Spy Talk again. I invite listeners to also take a peek at our Spy Talk newsletter. So we'll see you around.
Well,
next
thank
time.
You very much. It's been thank a great you. Pleasure. And keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you. We will. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Thanks much for listening. You can find lots more interesting conversations like this one in our archives, available at our home at the MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, you'll find your way there. This week's Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
SOW Media.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
You didn't start a business just to keep the lights on. You're here to sell more today than yesterday. You're here to win. Lucky for you, Shopify built the best converting checkout on the planet. Like the just one tapping, ridiculously fast acting, sky high sales stacking champion of checkouts. That's the good stuff right there. So if your business is in it to win it, win with Shopify. Start your free trial today at shopify.com/win.